So you've decided to give up that old behavior that's been killing you and all you care for and surrender to a power greater than yourself. That's the first step. Surrender is what opens the prison door. Now it's time to walk through that door and into a whole new way of life. Spirituality, self-care, service, social connection, and the simple daily disciplines that pave the way to lasting freedom. This is Positive Sobriety.
Welcome to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and I'm David Hampton, and I am your single host today. Our co-host and friend, Nate Larkin, is off enjoying some time away in beautiful California with his beautiful wife, Allie, and celebrating a wedding anniversary and having a great time. And Nate, we miss you, but we know that you're having a great time, and we wish you and Allie a very happy anniversary. But Rex and I are here, and we have a great guest today. And, you know, it's a great thing when you meet people with incredible stories, and you watch how your relationship with them shapes your direction and how their road takes them on into some other real exciting things. And that's kind of the relationship I have with our guest today. Dr. Monty Burks is with us. And I have known Monty for quite a few years now here in the greater Nashville area. And Monty, I'll tell you more about him as we get into the interview, but Monty has a passion for recovering people because he is a recovering person, but his story is incredible. You aren't going to want to miss him sharing with you the power of one person and one voice that altered the course of a life and the places that he has been able to go and take his message of hope and recovery. And Monty is contagious and affectionate and somebody that you're going to feel a great affinity for when he starts to tell you just how beautifully the path for him was laid out once he surrendered to the fact that he had come to the end of himself. So you're not going to want to miss this. Stay with us. And then at the end of our episode today, I want to introduce you to the guy behind the scenes that you never get to hear from, and that's Rex Schnelly, our producer and engineer. And Rex has a special endeavor that he's been a part of with his creative work and music, and we're going to talk just a little bit at the end about that. So stay with us. We've got a lot to cover. It's the Positive Sobriety Podcast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and I'm David, and again, our co-host is out this week. Nate is celebrating an anniversary with Allie in a beautiful part of California, and but we are here today, and we are moving on because we have some exciting stuff to cover. I have a friend here that's joining us today, and Dr. Monty Burks from the state of Tennessee Department of Mental Health, but he's the director of the faith-based initiatives for the state of Tennessee with regard to recovery and helping faith-based organizations learn how to engage. And Monty, welcome, welcome, welcome to our podcast, to our audience.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, man. It's a blessing to be here. Thank you, friend, for allowing me to come out. I wish I'd been able to come out here earlier.
Well, we would love to have you anytime. So
yes, sir.
We're just glad to get you. And so, Monty, first of all, tell me a little bit about what you do, what your role is in the state. Most of our friends listening probably don't even know that the state engages in any faith-based initiatives at all with regard to recovery.
Well, my title is Director of Faith-Based Initiatives. I'm with the Tennessee Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services. And what my job is to engage our faith community from an organic level and help our congregations build recovery programs and address addiction and mental health issues according to their denomination, in their pews, in their communities, and be able to get some type of resources to them, whether it's just informational resources mm-hmm. or connections to be able to help individuals access recovery services and possibly mm-hmm. even get people into treatment. Mm-hmm. One of our overall goals is to create more access points through our faith community to get people into services.
Right.
So my job is to be the bridge between our faith communities and our evidence-based programs, our traditional mm-hmm. programs, mm-hmm. also our prevention coalitions and our recovery courts. I work mm-hmm. closely with the court systems and some of our traditional state systems.
Right.
But our congregations are actually older than any of our traditional systems that we use.
Mm.
So we want to make sure that our congregations are plugged in on every single level and gap so we can be better equipped to address people in the community.
Right. So I imagine one of the things you push against dealing with faith-based groups and churches and things like that is the helping them come to a better understanding of the moral issue of addiction, that there might be this conflict with sometimes the church is so concerned about behavior that we don't understand the sickness or why the pain. And so do you guys help churches understand the difference between this is not just a bunch of misbehaving people, we're asking you to
Absolutely. So one of the things we do is we travel across the state and we connect with our communities. We go county to county. I have a team.
Mm-hmm.
We have three faith-based coordinators. Each mm-hmm. one of them serve one of each Tennessee's grand divisions, the three stars.
Mm-hmm.
And then that works closely with them is our Tennessee Project Lifeline. Each one of those individuals, their job is to reduce stigma in communities
mm-hmm.
as well as provide access points to services. What we do is we go out and connect with our congregations and pull community collaborations, and we come in and talk about the addicted brain,
mm-hmm.
the addicted process, how trauma works, what ACEs are.
Mm-hmm.
We want our faith community to look at addiction beyond the language of moral failing
mm-hmm.
and look at it as a treatable disease.
Mm-hmm.
Look at it that sometimes behaviors are caused by trauma that was well before any of us even realized that there was a traumatic event.
Right.
And that shows its head. It doesn't do the same in every person. We know that everybody doesn't conceptualize recovery the same.
Mm-hmm.
People that don't understand the recovery process, sometimes they don't understand what a person's been through to get to where they are.
Mm-hmm.
So that person surviving is a walking testimony and a testament to the hard work that the faith communities are already doing, whether they know it or not. So we want to make sure that our faith communities are on the same page with us. We know that they provide a powerful service outside of anything government can ever do.
Right.
And we want to make sure that we walk with them, alongside them, not as a challenge, but more as a supplement.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that spiritual or pastoral support in a congregation is the number one thing.
Mm-hmm.
When a person is identifies with their faith, and they follow leadership in their congregation,
mm-hmm.
they will tell their pastor what they won't tell their doctor
mm-hmm.
or their lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
They will be truthful with them.
Mm-hmm.
So what we want to make sure is those pastors, we're beside them as a resource.
Right.
However they use us.
Right.
Even if it's just to get information, maybe to build their own program
mm-hmm.
or connect with other congregations that do similar work.
Mm-hmm.
We have congregations we work with in every single county in the state. We have congregations that are our friends, and we
wow.
work with them in some capacity. There is conversations about, you know, is this a choice?
Mm-hmm.
Well, obviously, we all as people in some point in our life make choices to do things.
Mm-hmm.
But we as people of faith understand that the ramifications of what we're trying to get from ill-advised choices.
Mm-hmm.
So we want to make sure that we offer resources. We're trying to find recovery. And we're trying to help communities find it, build it, and facilitate it.
Right, right. And so when you get into a faith-based group, a church, and you have people that want to help and they want to reach out, they want to form some kind of care teams, how can your team come in and help train them what is helpful, what isn't helpful? Things like that.
Well, our faith-based coordinators, they're the beginning piece to getting our congregations equipped. So what they do is their job is to work with our congregations to figure out, one is what they want to do, what they're willing to do, and what they can do. There's a lot of issues around capacity. We know that we want to do all of these wonderful things, but sometimes we don't necessarily have the tools yet to do that.
Right.
So our faith-based coordinators kind of connect the dots, figure out what the congregation's capacity is, what they would like to do, because all of our congregations are not going to do the same types of recovery work. Sometimes they don't identify with certain types of 12 steps. Sometimes our in the Christian religion, some of the 12 steps, they want the 12 step studies to be more closely related to celebrate recovery, or recovery within Christ, or recovery through Christ. Whereas some of our other faith traditions will be open to other types of recovery or 12 step meetings. But what we want to do is meet them where they are, whatever they're comfortable with. Once they've identified and met with our faith-based coordinators, then we send a second set, our Project Lifeline. Project Lifeline are all trained in how to build capacity from the ground. That means they'll identify the champions in the congregation, figure out whatever. A lot of our congregations are filled with such, they're all filled with people that have these unique backgrounds through life that can be coupled together to build this amazing recovery community within their walls. And we want to get tools to them, get them into trainings on mental health, suicide, addiction, recovery, treatment. Get them all to the table. Bring some of our medical professionals to come in and talk about the process that goes on in the brain, the chemistry changing. That's been a unique process to open the door to that conversation. But it's actually helped us build relationships with clergy because we give them the science behind brain addiction. And it's not a challenge to a belief system. But here's an explanation of just what's happening. This is the physical thing that's happening to this person.
That there is physiology associated with addictive behaviors that needs to be understood so that we can better help the person without shaming or going to behavior, making it all about the behavior.
Absolutely. When we latch on to a behavior, we'll leave a person at that behavior. We'll leave them where that stands. You know, I'm a person that's in long-term recovery, and I openly advocate for individuals who hurt like me. I had hurts, habits, and hang-ups, and I had allowed myself to be consumed by a new community of people who weren't conducive to recovery because that's who would embrace me. And as I what happened is a lady from a local church in Murfreesboro actually prayed with me and took me to a 12-step meeting. And that was almost 20 years ago. But because of her walk, because of her not judging me at that moment and realizing that I had something greater in me, I was through that 12-step meeting, I was introduced to treatment. And I did 271 days inpatient. And the recovery meeting, that the 12-step meeting that I went to, I would have never went to treatment. I would have never went to a recovery meeting if it wasn't at a church. I grew up in the church. My father was Catholic and my mother was Pentecostal. So for everybody listening, I have my own set of stuff going on right now. I'll tell you what.
I can only imagine.
Oh, man. And, you know, being able to go back into a congregation, I always felt that the congregation was the last place I wanted to go talk about my addiction. I always felt that I could talk about other things, but not addiction. And I was actually diagnosed with a medical, with a clinical diagnosis, depression. And the depression was a product of the long-term drug use. I went through withdrawals, man. I went through it all. And I had a church walk with me, and what they didn't understand, they learned. So instead of doing, catching me at a spot and keeping me accountable at a spot, they helped me grow as a person. And then I was able to come back as, you know, years later as an ambassador and say, hey, look, this is what recovery looks like. My recovery was found through the church. The church helped me find it. You know, the cool thing about our faith is once you know, this is my personal opinion for all those listening, is the stronger my faith got, the more I realized that I had to go out with the people who didn't have a belief system or who were a little different than me. And utilize my mission as the hands and feet to be able to guide them, to help them find what recovery looks like. And that's been a beautiful part of my life.
And that is, you know, positive sobriety. That's what we talk about or try to talk about every week here. And so take me back a little bit. So you've alluded now, you know, you've told us a little bit about the fact that you did do some time in treatment and you had some pretty, it sounds like pretty significant experiences with your recovery. Take me back to what, to a little bit about your story. Where'd you grow up? How did you find yourself into, you know, moving into a place that you probably didn't plan on being?
Well, you know, you're right. You know, nobody wakes up and says, hey, I'm going to have a mental health diagnosis, or hey, I'm going to be a drug addict.
Right.
Nobody gets up and says those things. Mm-hmm. You know, I grew up in Winchester, Tennessee, which is about an hour and 15 minutes from here southeast going toward Chattanooga. Mm-hmm. I grew up very rural. The communities were very connected. Mm-hmm. I actually grew up on a street that had a mini part called Churchtown. The street was shaped like a horseshoe. And there were three churches, one at each piece of the horseshoe.
Oh, wow.
It was a Baptist church, a Church of God, and an African Methodist Episcopal church. Okay. All three in one spot.
Yeah.
And we all knew each other, but we didn't all worship together, but we still knew each other. Mm-hmm. You know, but it was a unique experience. I grew up, I played sports. I was very active in my community. But I had started to experiment when I was around 13 or 14 years old. It came from boredom.
Mm-hmm.
I still was able to go through school. I made really good grades. I didn't miss a lot of school.
Mm-hmm.
For the most part, I was a really good student.
Yeah.
Went to college.
Mm-hmm.
Once I left my community, I didn't have to be a good kid anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Growing up in my small town, I knew everybody and everybody knew me.
Right.
So I could get a switch whooping by a woman I didn't know because she knew my grandmother from 20 years ago. I didn't have to know her for her to know me.
Uh-huh.
But
okay.
when I moved, there was no... there was no structure that way. I moved to Murfreesboro, to MTSU, and when I went to college, I was wide open.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't connected to a church. I wasn't connected to a faith community, and I almost felt as though I had found some type of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't freedom that I found. I actually walked straight into oppression, and I connected with young people. I grew customary to the party lifestyle. That was what I did.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, 2.5 years later, I had been suspended from school for not coming and failing mm-hmm. all my classes. I was homeless, sleeping in the back of my car.
Okay.
And I would not call home and tell my family.
Mm.
I knew what to say to them.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have cell phones back then. And mm-hmm. I think the closest we had was a pager.
Uh-huh.
But I would still stay connected. I'd go home in my Sunday's best. And mm-hmm. I would be my Sunday's best, but I was at my worst point in my life. But because I could wear that mask, mm-hmm. they didn't know. I come mm-hmm. from a really good family, man.
Mm-hmm.
My mother's, she's worked for the state of Tennessee, for the University of Tennessee for 30 years.
Wow.
My father was a Marine Corps. He's passed away now. He's in the Marine Corps. I have a wonderful stepfather who was military.
Wow.
I grew up, I had a life,
mm-hmm.
but something happened.
Mm-hmm.
I took a wrong turn,
mm-hmm.
and the wrong turn, it consumed me to the point where I almost died in my addictions.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thankful in the process. I'm thankful that I still had my connection to the faith community, because the day that my walk into recovery started was the day the lady put her arm on my shoulder and told me. She was a lady from one of the local churches that knew my mother that I didn't necessarily know.
Mm.
She knew my mother. She caught me in Murfreesboro eating lunch, and she knew my mother from Winchester.
Oh, man.
She put her hand, it was the divine intervention. It was divine timing. Mm-hmm. She mm-hmm. She put her hand on me and said, I need you to go to a meeting. Now, you see, we as Southern people, Southern males,
mm-hmm.
We've always been taught that you don't have emotions as a man.
Mm-hmm.
You don't cry.
Right.
Because you're weak.
Mm-hmm.
That's not true.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've done is we've created generations of men who don't cry,
right?
Who don't weep, who don't mm-hmm. show emotion,
mm-hmm.
and they pass that on to their kids.
Mm-hmm.
So we have men who have experienced trauma and pain and grief and suffering and have never dealt with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I told her, the first thing she said to me is, when you need to go to a meeting, I said, not me. What are you talking about?
Mm-hmm.
I was automatically in defense mode
mm-hmm.
because I was like, I can fix it myself. I grew mm-hmm. up, my granddaddy taught me how to fix a car when I was two.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what can you tell me? What meeting are you talking about?
Yeah.
And instead of her backing away from me, she came to me with love
mm-hmm.
and hugged me and said, nah, you're going to go to a meeting with me. Now, she was a church person. She was in the church. Her words to me, how she spoke to me, she triggered something in me because she spoke to me biblically.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, okay, I'll go.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. she connected with me on that level.
Yeah.
And I went to her, I went to the 12 step, ended up in treatment, and I can attribute that to me growing up in the pews of a sanctuary. Mm-hmm. You know, my uncle was a fire and brimstone preacher. I tell people all the time, I'm still scared of him to this day. But you know, when I told him, I said, man, I was coming and I was a full blown addict. And he said, man, I had no idea. He said, I wish you told me. Mm-hmm. And I told him, and it really set in with him. He said, man, I would have loved you and tried to help you. And mm-hmm. I wouldn't have known what to do at the time. Mm-hmm. He said, I would have prayed for you. He said, but you know, he even acknowledged that his training hadn't had him prepared for the things that we were going through
right.
as a faith community.
Right.
And he was like, man, you know, but now he's got an opportunity. Now he's seen, I am a product of successful intervention with the faith community, connecting someone to a program. I had to go, it took a church to get me to a secular program to be able to come back to the church and understood what the message of the church was.
Yeah, yeah.
That was my process.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It is.
And so all of this leads you into this really unique...
Yes.
You know, but it's like these stepping stones, you know, and so here you are now in a place where... 20 years later?
Yes, sir. 19 years and 3 months, man.
Wow.
I'm go ahead and adding ahead because the 20 is on the horizon. March 3rd was my 19 year.
Wow.
And
well, congratulations on that, first of all,
you.
On behalf
thank you,
of
thank
all
you.
Of us.
And it was a divine, this role has been a divine intervention and walk in my recovery because it's empowered me mm-hmm. to empower others.
Mm-hmm.
And I was this unique role. I am a faith-based director, and I work for the Tennessee Department of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services.
Mm-hmm.
I get to go out. My job is to go out to our faith community
mm-hmm.
and get down in the trench
mm-hmm.
and help.
Yeah.
What better mission in life
right.
could a man have?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and that's beautiful because you did something recently, and this is I want to dovetail this in our conversation. You got a PhD, but not in addiction or behavioral health.
I did not. So I have a master's degree in criminal justice,
mm-hmm.
and I took this role. I had started my doctoral studies at Tennessee State University in public administration.
Mm-hmm.
I had been an adjunct instructor of criminal justice for years at mm-hmm. different universities. I taught at Tennessee State, Motlow Community College, and Ball State. Mm-hmm. I've been very active with us. I'm still very active in those universities,
mm-hmm.
and they're all very active in the recovery community as well.
Yeah.
I've been able to take back information to staff and to the young people.
Right.
But in my role, I saw a connection. I was pulled into the role as a special projects director to work with the faith community.
Mm-hmm.
And there were special projects and faith-based initiatives. That was my initial title. I saw the need for a connection deeper than just who I was as a government role.
Mm-hmm.
I needed my education to surround the communities I worked with. Mm-hmm. And I needed to have a better understanding of my different denominations mm-hmm. and how powerful they were.
Right.
And when I say that, our denominations, our congregations, our churches, they're older than any institution that any one of us will ever serve in.
Yeah.
All the hospitals, all the research that's being done, all of the science, those are the answers to somebody's prayers who've been long and gone.
Mm-hmm.
And I had an opportunity to get in the middle of that. So I switched my doctoral studies over to theology, historical theology. I worked with Heritage, and I still am very active with Heritage. And I studied the landscape of Tennessee. I went through each county, all 95 counties, and we pulled the information on how many congregations there were and how many people of faith attended service on a weekly basis.
Wow.
And then we pulled some correlations from the Department of Health and the United States Census Bureau, and we found that in 2016, there were 3,000 people of faith per one person who died of an overdose death in Tennessee.
Wow.
And there were 2,170 something people who died of a suicide in 2016 per one per 20 I'm sorry 2,173 people of faith per one person who died of a suicide. Let me make sure I clarify that.
Yeah.
So what we found was, is we have the power in the pews of our sanctuaries to be the difference.
Yeah.
To be the intercessor.
Yeah.
To be the buffer in the community.
Well, because you're living proof that it only takes one.
It only takes one.
So if we've got 3,000 people per overdose death in the state, 3,000 people of faith, that to every overdose death that we see.
Yes, sir.
And it only really takes one person to come in and put your arm around somebody and know to love, you know, and you don't have to have PhDs to love people.
No, you do not. I just had that conversation with I met a lady in West Tennessee a couple of days ago, and she is in her early 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And she said that she has taken a new career,
mm-hmm.
and that's mentoring people that are coming through the system.
Wow.
And it was such a blessing that when it was over, I had to go hug her.
Mm.
Because her comment drew a standing ovation from a room full of practitioners, 300 people. She was there as a volunteer to listen and to figure out what resources were there. She had just started to understand brain trauma and ACEs, adverse childhood experiences syndrome.
Right.
And she's like, you know, I'm working with these people. I only mentor three people.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I have time for.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wow, what if everybody took her model?
Mm-hmm.
What if everybody stayed connected to three people that you weren't related to or that you had no relationship with and said, hey, listen, I've been able to survive this long.
Mm-hmm.
Let me help you get on the right path. I think that, and this is from a personal standpoint, our faith encourages us to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that that's part of who we are as people that have hope and belief, is we have to go out and hold people's hands and pull them. And look, I get it. I'll go get in the pit with somebody. I'm one of the broken, so I know what it feels like.
Right.
So sometimes I know that I can't, I know now that I can't fix anybody, but I can help them find resources to fix themselves. And I can be part of that. And sometimes we have to take, you know, we can go scriptural. I'll just go get in the pit and sit there with them. Like, hey, look, I figured out how to get out of this pit.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe me and you can figure this thing out together.
Yeah.
Would you like some coffee?
Right.
Would you like some coffee?
Right. Yeah. But so you're this guy that had the experience with one person, and we know that we've got enough people in the state who are in some kind of faith professing congregation.
Yes, sir.
And so if a congregation wants to know how to become really useful in this overwhelming, when we hear the news every day, you know, overwhelming battle that we are in as a culture. What's the first thing somebody in a church could do who is one person who says, how can we engage a few people here who are close to this?
Absolutely. So me and my team, first, I'm going to plug my team. Mm-hmm. That's okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go to tn.gov/behavioral health and look up faith-based initiatives. Our faith-based coordinators they serve the whole state.
Mm-hmm.
I would encourage, if you're in a congregation, the first thing to do is work on the process of loving thy neighbor where they are, as God made them. Giving people a hug no matter how dirty they are, how they smell, how they speak, how they look.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second step is connect with some of the outside resources just in case they need to go a step further.
Mm-hmm.
Understanding the difference between treatment and recovery support,
mm-hmm.
understanding that there are ways to get people into treatment programs who don't have insurance,
mm-hmm.
that don't have resources.
Mm-hmm.
There are counselors, there are therapists, there are sponsors in the communities that are all in positions where they can serve. That would be the next step. And go and connect with I work as a faith-based director. I have these coordinators that will come to your congregation, just to your congregation, to meet just you.
Mm-hmm.
All they need you to do is to contact them or for you to contact us. That's what I would suggest that. You can also email me at monty.burks, monty.burks, monty.burks@tn.gov. I would love to connect our congregations to any types of resources or information possible. We know that in Tennessee, all congregations don't have the same capacity. Some have three people, some have 30,000.
Mm-hmm.
We do know that the three and the 30,000 can all be of resource to somebody else.
Right.
Each one of them can be responsible for saving somebody's lives. And just on another note, I talked about Project Lifeline.
Mm-hmm.
We just pulled the data yesterday. Project Lifeline's been in existence for 6 years, 6.5 years. They're all in long-term recovery. They're all individuals that have a faith-based background.
Mm-hmm.
They're all in long-term recovery. They have been responsible in the last 4 years for referring 8,170 people into treatment.
Wow.
They wear holy blue jeans, Chuck Taylors, and torn shirts.
Mm-hmm.
They will meet you. They'll meet you at McDonald's.
Mm-hmm.
They'll meet you at your house. They'll meet you at the crack house.
Mm-hmm.
Their job is to get in and try to help you find a way out. And they're part of our team. So if you want to connect, I would love to connect with you. I'd love to connect you with our team. David Hampton is also part of my team. you know, he's a brother from another mother. We are two men of faith who have taken a significant part of our life and devoted it to helping other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and you've been a great encouragement to me as we were working together more when I was on a church staff and helped the church I served at the time become a certified recovery congregation.
Absolutely, man. And you know what? You and Mr. Gary and Shannon.
Yeah,
yes,
absolutely.
Yes, yes.
With United Methodist Church.
Yes,
yeah.
Yes. And you know, David, I want to say this to the audience. And I know everybody, you know, I know we have our own different belief systems, or we have our own way we go about things, but this is a comment or a question.
Mm-hmm.
If our congregations don't get in front of addiction,
mm-hmm.
who else will?
Right.
That's
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Community-based capacity starts at the oldest institutions we have. We have almost 12,000 congregations in Tennessee.
Wow.
That's the largest demographic community that across all demographics,
mm-hmm.
the largest community. You have a congregation, a sheriff's department, and a health department in every county. And when people get broke,
mm-hmm.
that's the three places they end up.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Our congregation has a unique opportunity because in government, we look at it as prevention, treatment, recovery.
Mm-hmm.
Relapse falls in the middle of all of that.
Mm-hmm.
But the congregations fall in the middle of all of that.
Yeah.
Faith communities can do things that no program that I'll ever work with will be able to do.
Mm-hmm.
They're able to identify from a culturally competent standpoint what their community needs because mm-hmm. they look like their community.
Mm-hmm.
They speak like their community. You know,
right.
East Tennessee and West Tennessee almost look like two different states sometimes.
Yeah.
It's the same Tennesseans.
Yeah.
We all love barbecue.
Yeah.
But when you talk about cultural issues or you talk about community issues, and then you go into our congregations who are made up of collectives of those communities.
Mm-hmm.
This is where recovery starts.
Mm-hmm.
This is where recovery can start.
Yeah.
This is where we can get people back to work. We can get people to the hospital and we can get the communities to start embracing people in recovery and walking with them on their journey.
Yeah.
Understanding that our faith communities can be the driving force behind that.
Yeah.
I was invited to present at the National RX Summit 3 weeks ago in Atlanta. And the president, his staff reached out to me and asked me, could the president use some of the stuff we'd done? And, you know, they asked me, this was an honor.
Mm-hmm.
A sitting United States president reached out to a man in long-term recovery
mm-hmm.
and said, we'd like to use some of your information. He was going to quote me. Well, a few hours later, they called me back and said, hey, the president would like for you to sit beside him and First Lady Trump. And we would like to introduce you and have you say a few words about what you do and your recovery.
Wow.
So, hey, I grew up Pentecostal, everybody listening. They gave me a microphone, and I did exactly what you think I did.
Man.
Yes. You can look it up. It's on. I made all the national news headlines.
Yeah.
It's on our department's Facebook page.
I got to see this.
Yes,
yeah, I'm going after it.
I took it to church. Choir boy, take it to church. And that's exactly what I did.
Uh-huh.
And it was there were 4,000 professionals in the addiction and recovery, addiction treatment prevention field. They were from all over the world.
Wow.
And it was a standing ovation. Because,
man.
And I just talked about the need of the faith community and how the paradigm shift happens
uh-huh.
right in the pews of our sanctuaries.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And the following week, I was invited to the White House to the National Day of Prayer. I sat in the Rose Garden. So this was a comment that I made. I said, 19 years ago, I was in treatment. And today I'm sipping tea in the Rose Garden with faith leaders from around the country. There was the Muslim community. There was the Jewish community. There was this the Sikh community. Mm-hmm. There was the Hindu community.
Mm-hmm.
We all got together outside of our belief differences,
right,
to talk about how our faith can be important in moving things forward.
Right.
And actually, I ran into Winona Judd. Winona, if you can hear me, I'm a huge fan of yours. I ran into Winona Judd.
At the White House.
At the White House.
See,
at the
National Day of Prayer. See, who gets to say that, Monty? Who gets to say that?
I took a selfie with Mike Pence.
Gets to say that?
I met Kenneth Copeland.
Okay.
John Hagee.
Uh-huh.
Jensen Franklin.
Okay.
These were all the individuals that I was allowed to be able to mingle with. And as a testament to the power of our congregations, if that one lady from the church hadn't have just took an extra minute to minister to me.
Yeah.
She ministered to me and got me to that point. If it wasn't for her, because I had, through my battles with addiction, I didn't go into how long it was. There were years there that I had walked into a community and I had fooled myself into thinking that that was my community. Mm. This is who I was going to be.
Mm-hmm.
So do you know how thick the scales were on my eyes?
Mm.
And when my vision was cleared, I was allowed to see life from a whole different set of eyes.
Yeah.
The beauty and not seeing things that I'd missed.
Yeah.
And people's lives that I hadn't been a part of. And I'm thankful that I've been able to go back and be in their lives.
Mm-hmm.
And they love me. They love me for where I'm at. And, you know, I've graduated school. I work in the recovery community. I've been through it all, man.
Yeah.
I've been through bits and pieces of everything.
Yeah.
And for anybody listening, remember that your loved one, we talk about positive sobriety, but sometimes as we, in our travel, in the time span, is we have to make sure we don't have compassion fatigue.
Yeah.
And we start forgetting about individuals who were where we were.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say this, you know, at some point I remember looking at myself like I was David and Goliath was my addiction.
Mm-hmm.
And then I can remember it was laid on my heart that some of the people that should have helped me were actually the Goliath.
Mm.
Some of the people that had the capacity, the power and the position, and they just didn't exactly walk in that particular purpose at that time.
Mm-hmm.
They had the power and they had become a Goliath to me.
Mm.
They had been the weapon that was not going to prosper against me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was able to move through that. I am a strong believer in divine everything.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that we walk in purpose.
Right.
And I believe that everything that happened to me was part of who I am now.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that, and I say this to everyone, and I'll leave it here, is that a seed does not get to pick where it's planted.
Wow. Yeah.
And it has to grow.
Mm.
If it doesn't grow, it dies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But when it grows, a rose can grow from concrete.
Yeah.
And you think about that. That's what recovery is.
Mm-hmm.
Like, wow, where do those flowers come from?
Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody planted it and somebody watered it and somebody fed it.
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden, we have a beautiful flower right there in the middle of a concrete and metal slab.
Mm-hmm.
Because somebody cared enough to see that it had potential
and
it had purpose.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man, I get emotional thinking about that. I'm thankful,
well,
man.
Yeah. I mean, well, and we who are in recovery every day as a gratitude exercise, I mean, we've got to have it, and keeps us centered and sober,
and yes.
All those other things. But Monty, I listen to this story and I just think, like, rolling everything all the way back, like you said, to that moment of the woman who came around to you, and that one little act is such a simple act. I mean, it wasn't easy. I'm sure it was, I'm sure she may have had a conversation with herself about whether to come up and approach you or not, but it's such a simple act in that it didn't require a lot of other things for her to do that. And I hope our listeners take away that they need to feel empowered.
Do you know what I found out later why she walked up to me?
Mm-mm.
And she didn't tell me for years. I just thought, she saw. It was laid on her heart.
Mm-hmm.
She had a perspective through experience. She had lost someone close to her post-Vietnam to alcoholism.
Mm.
She saw the demon.
Mm-hmm.
And I had no idea. She saw me.
Mm-hmm.
And she saw straight through me.
Mm-hmm.
And she knew in her heart, she said, I knew that if I didn't grab you right then, that you might not have made it another day. And I'll be honest with you, I don't think I would have.
Wow.
I was at that spot.
Yeah. Man.
You know, and it was a rough for her to say that to me later. She didn't even realize I was at rock bottom. I was there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had like $20 in my pocket, and that was it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was trying to take care of a kid. I couldn't keep a job. I mean, I was going through everything that's mm-hmm. correlated to addiction.
Yeah.
And right then, and later in life, she told me she'd lost somebody close to her, and that her ministry was to help me at that moment.
Mm.
So, hey, if you're listening, yeah, that's real.
Mm.
That's what recovery is to me. And part of my recovery is knowing that you're listening, because I know there's a bunch of doers out there.
Mm-hmm.
Recovery, faith, to me, both equal do.
Yeah.
Because if we do nothing, nothing will be done.
Right. That's a good place to wrap up, man. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me, man. I'm coming back.
Yeah.
Whenever you guys invite me, I'm coming back. I'd love to come back and sit with you. And if anybody doesn't know this, David is a musician. He's pretty good. I happen to hear him. So, but I'm thankful to be here, man.
Well, thank you for the plug. I appreciate that. Hey, sometime
no
I'll play the piano again. Maybe. Who knows?
Yes, sir.
But, man, thank you. It is great to have you.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Well, we'll be right back. And don't go anywhere. We'll be right back on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Welcome back to the Positive Sobriety Podcast, and man, I love that guy. That is such a fun conversation and such a hopeful conversation for any of us that are in recovery, and some days we struggle, and some days we wonder what the point is, and we just wonder if there's any purpose to any of this, and we wonder if we weren't just a little bit happier back in our old self, and then you have a conversation like today with Monty, and you remember that, man, there is purpose written all over recovery. And so I want to introduce our audience to the guy that we never get to hear from, and we just have a few minutes here with our friend Rex Schnelli. And Rex is our producer, engineer, and edits our broadcast, brings all this stuff together in his musical magic world back there. But Rex is, what you don't know, some of you may know, a phenomenal world-class musician, guitar player, and he has just released a really cool project with a guy named Phil Kagi that many of you may know who have followed music for the last little bit. And Phil and Rex have released this project together, co-artists. And so we want a chance to let Rex tell you about the project, where to get it, how to find more great music in your library that just you can plug in and just lose yourself in. Rex, tell us about this thing you and Phil did.
Yeah, it's really so exciting just because he's a hero of mine, and through the years we've gotten to work together on various projects. My project, actually, back in 2005 is when we began to work together.
Wow.
And we've done our various overdubs. I've actually invited him more often to play on my stuff just because, you know, he is Phil Kagi. So it was, but as we started to kind of hang out together and be in each other's lives and become really close friends, we just kind of started kicking around this idea. I worked on his previous record, a record that was called All at Once, that was about 2 years ago, and we wrote a song on it and produced it, and it happened so quickly. Literally in 2 days it was done.
Wow.
And as a producer, part of my job is finding ways to work with people and their strengths. And so sometimes you can get lost chasing rabbits. But what I usually do is bring that energy together and then be purposeful. Mm-hmm. So I asked Phil, I said, would you allow me to kind of direct our writing sessions and what mm-hmm. we do? And just to set the task and set the momentum. And so mm-hmm. we did that. And, man, things just started to really pop. Began with a recording from 1971 of one of the first songs he had written when he became a born again believer as a Christian artist, but the energy was just all of this fresh, creative, melodic stuff that was happening about that same time, and he played it for me, and I said it was just a chorus about 20 seconds, and I said okay, there's our starting point.
Wow.
And then what I wanted to do was bring the aesthetic of modern progressive rock, modern rock. An edge to it, precision to it, like Yes, like Foreigner, like all of the great bands that a lot of people kind of fall in love with, Level 42, Tears mm-hmm. for Fears, mm-hmm. you know, and then Eric Johnson, better guitar players, that kind of a thing. And so it fell together, and it really energized, became this shining, brilliant light. And then vocally, it actually became this incredible interplay of great harmonies, and I would do a verse, he would do a chorus, or vice versa.
Yeah.
And then our guitar playing was just a call and response to each other. And it was so free because you can actually tell the difference, and we're having fun. We're answering each other rather than competing with each other.
Like a musical conversation.
Like a musical conversation. So we're really excited.
That's awesome. So the name of the record
is Illumination.
All right.
And it is going to have a worldwide release May 31st. We're going to have a VIP show soon thereafter. Our vinyl, we're going to do some vinyl, so that'll be coming in at the end of the month. And we'll just see, you know, kind of where it goes. Don't know about touring, but we're open to that. McCain and Company, a PR company, is actually doing some of the press releases, and we're getting a lot of positive response, a lot of great reviews. Which,
man, that's great. That's so good.
Of course, these days, that's about your reward, you know. Forget about making money, you know.
You can cash those reviews.
That's right.
Well, man, I'm excited for you. This is going to be fun. I know it's going to be great, and I've heard a little bit. You've played me a few things, which I like. I always like sneak peeks, and it is awesome. It's beautiful. It's great. You guys are amazing, of course. And where can we get it?
Okay, so you need to go to Phil Kagey, and that's PhilKeagey. philkagey.com/store, and the first thing you'll see will be our pretty little faces on a record, kind of like a Star Wars movie poster, but anyway, that's what I've been told. So yeah, you can seek it out, and also his other work too, which is pretty brilliant, but that'll be a good place. Of course, it's Spotify, it's only all the aggregators, Spotify, iTunes, and you know, blah blah blah, and so you know, make throw us 0.0003 cents if you want to go listen there or whatever. But
eventually, you know, if you save your checks, you can you can buy milk.
But, there you go.
But man, it's worth it. It is so worth everybody investigating and taking a look at this, because I would love for you to benefit from that. You do so much for us, and we appreciate you and love you. You and I have been friends for longer than we are old, and
I just want to say it's been such a treat for me to be involved with the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Obviously, I do it out of selfish reasons. I get David Hampton and Nate Larkin once a week, you know, so that's like soul medicine, you know, free therapy, but really just reconnecting and being a part of a larger vision that actually is helping people. And obviously, our stories mix and have gone so far, and I just love where you are now, and your wheelhouse is spinning so effectively in the culture, and so I'm just so glad to be a part of this.
Well, man, thank you. It's great to have you on board with us. We love you and love what you bring to us. And so remember Illumination at philkagey.com/store, and hear Rex and Phil do some amazing music and amazing musical feats on that project. I am dead serious. So thank you all for being with us today. It is another great time on the Positive Sobriety Podcast. Nate will be back in a couple of weeks, and we will have more guests and more really important things to talk about. And so until then, be safe, and we love you. Take care, and let us hear from you. So we'll see you next time on the Positive Sobriety Podcast.
The Positive Sobriety Podcast is recorded at Crossroads for the Nations in Brentwood, Tennessee. Live producer Rex Schnelli, music by Rex Schnelli, theme music by Matt Ulrich, hair and makeup by Lyle Lovett, wardrobe by Kathy Gifford.